This week on Life and Faith.
It was interesting to live on a housing estate in the middle of a war zone. If you're a working class family moving from Britain to the sunshine of Perth, living in an asbestos house near the beach, that's, you know, the battler's blocks, but it's, you know, it's very much a Tim Winton view of the world.
It was next to Fremantle. It's not exactly the worst place to live.
Yeah. And then you move back to mid-Ulster in the middle of a war zone, and it's raining all the time, your parents are unemployed, and you've got baby brother and another on the way, and no money. It's a very unusual setting.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. David and Stephen McAlpine grew up in Northern Ireland and Australia. They are identical twins. Stephen is a writer and speaker about theology and culture. He's also a long-time church pastor. His twin David is a neuroscientist and is professor of hearing, language and the brain at Macquarie University's Australian Hearing Hub. Stephen is obviously a committed Christian. David is not a believer. They grew up in a conservative Protestant Christian family and took very different paths, not only in terms of their careers, but their beliefs and religious commitments. David lives in Sydney, Stephen in Perth. Are their beliefs as far apart as the cities they live in? Well, we wanted to find out. Not only are these guys identical twins, but they are identically stylish twins with a sort of hipster sensibility. It certainly made me look bland by comparison. They remain very close friends despite their differences, and we thought it would be fun to have them into the studio to talk about their, well, life and faith, or lack thereof. It's worth mentioning that not only do these guys obviously look the same, they sound similar as well, which is challenging for audio. We'll try to help you out with that along the way. Thanks so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thanks, Simon. Great to be here.
Now, we'll start with you, David. Tell us about growing up. What was life like in the McAlpine household in Portadown, Northern Ireland?
Life in Portadown, Northern Ireland was a mix of very closeted and a protected internal view in a war zone. Yeah. And that's a good way of describing it.
Yeah, because let's work out where you... So you guys are... early 50s, but so the time you were living there, this is tricky times in Northern Ireland.
That's correct. We lived in Northern Ireland before we were living in Portadown. We went to Australia from Belfast, but back to Portadown in the early 80s. It was hunger strikes. It was Thatcher's Britain. It was unemployment. It was housing estates with bombed out houses on it. It was chaotic. But in the midst of that, it was a very safe and protected culture, very segregated, obviously on religious lines, but also very protective of its own within a very tight family circle, I guess, but also a very strong persuasion about who you were, defined often by who you weren't.
Yes, indeed, in that place. So Protestant Christianity, Stephen, this was the vibe at your place?
Yeah, and I guess you that Protestant Christianity has a sweep from hard fundamentalism through to sort of more liberal expression.
And where were you sitting in that spectrum?
Well, I think we were just slightly to the left of hard right, I think, as growing up as in the church.
Pretty conservative.
It was conservative.
Fundamentalist?
It had elements of that. Mm. Our parents were married by the Reverend Dr. Ian Paisley, who became the Chief Minister of Northern Ireland stage. Mm. Though they had left because of the politics, but the aura of that hangs with you, I think.
And we were actually christened or dedicated by him as well. There's a picture of us in his arms. Yeah. Yes. We were 21 at the time.
No. Claim to fame.
Yeah, so that gives you a snapshot of it, I think, in that sense of what David's saying, is that aspect of it's tribal and it's very certain about a lot of things, and you live in a certain band of life. And I think it changed socioeconomically. The more money you had and more education you had, the less religious divide mattered in Northern Ireland, but not Portadown.
Now, just to help you out here, that was Stephen. This is David.
No, it's the last bastion of loyalist conservative Protestantism.
Yes.
And if you weren't, you moved out to the coast and the yacht clubs and Port Rushford, the golf club.
And thought about other things.
And thought about other things.
Now, you were not from that end of town, though. So it was pretty sort of working class environment. What were you like as kids in that environment? Were you similar? I think sport was an important thing.
Yeah. Look, we grew up with what we knew. Dad working in a factory.
Or not.
And that was the hard thing in Northern Ireland was unemployment. It just blew us away when we went back to Northern Ireland, how depressed it was as a place. But we did the sport thing. We went to school. We were quite competitive, as you do when you're twins. Your first competition is against each other. Mm-hmm. And then you go, hey, we could band together and we could be competition against other people.
Yeah, we shouldn't get the view across that somehow that was an aberration to our life. We lived in Perth for 7 years as the most conservative people in the city, virtually.
That's true.
We moved to Northern Ireland to of an environment where we actually felt very much at home. Religion and Christianity was a much bigger expression for good or ill in the society around us. The church was a big thing. And we got education in Northern Ireland. So we didn't suffer there, and we felt fairly at home. It was just a crushingly depressing place if you were anything other than 14, 15-year-old having a bit of a new experience.
Yeah, so tell us about this backwards and forwards between Perth in Australia and Northern Ireland. How did that happen?
Yeah, that I would say parents moving out to Australia.
And you're what age?
We were six. And then living in Perth, that was hard for our mother as much as anything because it's such a different environment. Perth in the 70s felt like a backwater in a different way. So Belfast, et cetera, was still at least part of the UK and was quite progressive in its technologies, et cetera, et cetera. And we found a kind of latent racism even towards Irish people in Australia, which was interesting. We hadn't picked that.
But it's something that's more evident in historically in New South Wales, of course.
Yeah.
But in the culture we were in, which was not Irish Catholic versus English Protestant, it was still a latent view that we were somehow, you know, lucky to be there, and did we have television in Ireland? No.
Yeah, that was a question that was asked several times. Do you have television in Ireland? Well, we had colour television in Ireland before you had coloured television, but
we got coloured television in 1975.
Yeah, and we came out in 73.
We didn't have a coloured television. No. It existed in Ireland.
Yeah, that's right. therein lies the issue that we came from a protected bubble in one sense to Perth, which felt very bleached out, very dry, very different. And in one sense, you could be anyone you wanted to be when you came to Perth, but we still stayed slightly enclavey, I think.
And then you go back to Ireland. Why is that? Homesick?
Yeah, my mum was a little homesick, and I think there was a promise that it would be the promised land a bit, and it didn't turn out to be. And that was two difficult years. I think we found that quite a struggle, didn't we?
It was interesting to live on a housing estate in the middle of a war zone. If you're a working class family, even from Britain to the sunshine of Perth, living in an asbestos house near the beach, I mean, it's, you know, the battler's blocks, but it's very much a Tim Winton view of the world.
It was next to Fremantle. It's not exactly the worst place to live.
Yeah. No. And then you move back to mid-Ulster in the middle of a war zone.
And it's raining all the time.
Your parents are unemployed and you've got a baby brother and another on the way and no money. It's a very unusual setting. But actually, I didn't feel very upset by that. I felt more upset about going back to Perth.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember you feeling much more upset about going back to Perth.
Yeah. And vowed to return to the UK, or what I thought was the UK. But it's ported out as not the UK as soon as I could, which I did.
You did do that. We'll get to that in a second. So you were both, believers then? You were brought up in a Christian home, but at that stage of life, Dave.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You felt like this was your belief.
Well, there wasn't even another conceptual framework for the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a fair perspective on it. And that's not a criticism, by the way. I think for most people on the planet, there's not another conceptual framework for the world that they're exposed to that actually takes them out of where they currently are. So that, it was our social life. It put us on stage. It got us thinking about education in a way our parents are not educated. Yeah. But beyond that, it was just the acceptance of this is the way the universe is. And we wouldn't question it. We knew that this was it.
Religion is a home game, as we'd say, not an away game in Northern Ireland.
Yes.
But it's also that the divide isn't between those who are perhaps Christian and those who maybe are not believers, but what type of Christian are you on the spectrum? And are you the good living type, which means you go to church, or are you just the normal Christian who is a cultural Christian? So
member of the Orange Order or something.
Yeah, so it's steeped in history, obviously, yeah. And it's become the identity, it is still the identity of Protestant is a loyalist to the crown, a Catholic is a Republican. And those things are so enmeshed that it's hard to see.
And that is a very different experience to hear. So you two sort of moving between the two, it's quite a unique experience, actually. Now, you set off for university and then took quite different paths. I think, David, you're obviously more the science route and Stephen, arts and writing, that kind of space. David, you then really took off in that career, and that gave you probably a big part of your identity, I imagine.
I think it was the education, not necessarily the science education, that gave to me. I actually sometimes think I could have been a researcher in anything. We had no experience of university, no pressure to do any education at all of any stripe, and that's quite liberating. But actually, when we went back to Australia, went back to Perth, we had 2 years of chaos in our family, and I went to university at UWA and left after a term because there was no one like me there. There was the chaos at home, plus the fact that everyone who was at UWA was a, you know, privately educated person who was on the just was novel. The
but class tell us
thing,
about that
know, class thing.
Tell us about that chaos at home, because I think this was formative in lots of ways.
It was very instructive to how we then moved into the rest of our lives. Our parents split up, and that was, you know, not something I think we necessarily need to go into too much about, but we had two baby brothers at home as well. We were living with our mother. Our father had left. And that was such a flip for us with respect to what we had experienced. In hindsight, looking back at people what we knew in church and others, and then we didn't see them again, life actually happens to people, and we were too closeted from that.
Yeah, it just didn't, like, those sort of things didn't happen to us.
Right.
And I think when they did happen to us, that's discombobulating and throws your world. So I ended up doing, you know, to uni, and it was, you know, the first couple of weeks into uni, and I'm going, I was a bit different. I went to a lesser university, shall
it's
we say.
It's now a very good turn there. curtain.
Yeah. A lot of the people I did do, you know, postmodern lit degree, you know, I was well up the food chain socially compared to a lot of them. But I can see how UWA and the science thing and the western suburbs of Perth was a very different experience for people coming from working class Northern Irish background.
It's instructive to know that our father left the night before Stephen and I went to university.
Okay.
Yeah. So leaving our mother with four sons at home, two under the age of five, and $1.
Yeah.
So there were certain pressures.
Yeah. That'll leave a bit of a flavour.
A sting.
For O Week.
Yeah, that did.
We didn't go to O Week. O Week was not a McAlpine thing.
No, that's true.
Right. You weren't in toga parties. And,
no.
Oh, you missed out.
I'll take your word.
So you head off then. You did your degree, but then you went on to other degrees in the UK.
That's right.
You went to Oxford, David. We're talking to David now. I know they sound the same, but let's keep identifying each of you. Tell us about that experience and how that shaped you.
That was amazing. It did shape me. I think university, when I went back after a year of not being there, or nearly a year of not being, I now knew what I wanted to do. I was focused. I knew what I didn't want to do, which was to not use my brain in something. And I went to Oxford. Again, that was a step up. That was a huge step up again. It was fantastic fun. Played a lot of sport, a lot of cricket. Uh-huh. But actually, just the environment of that, it was very, as in most scientific research communities, very close family. Everyone is from all over the world, so your lab is your family.
Yeah.
But then you had the college system at Oxford, which was great fun. And I also had a first child by then and was married for the first time then. So it was a huge step in 1990 as a 22-year-old to, you know, get married, move country, have a child and start a PhD at Oxford in 11 months.
Yeah, that is.
That was a big, that was quite a transformative year.
Yeah. This is Life and Faith, and today we're talking to Stephen and David McAlpine. They're two identical twins. Stephen is a pastor and writer. He blogs on theology and culture. David's a professor of hearing, language, and the brain, and a non-believer. And from here in the interview, we talk about science, supernatural, how people come to believe or disbelieve. Also, how these two processed a very serious and grim health diagnosis for Stephen. As we said earlier, they both grew up Christians, but eventually David left the faith of his childhood. And I asked him, what was the most influential factor in that shift?
It was probably happening in my early to mid-20s, where I couldn't reconcile stating that I believed something with actually what I believed. I know that sounds trite, maybe, or even bizarre, but if you've only known and your only social interaction and your only engagement is in this space, then you're not just stopping believing something you believe. You're actually saying, I'm abandoning my entire engagement with people and they're all going to hate me as well.
Right, okay. So and it's a kind of a community thing too.
It's a really important community. Yeah, and I have lots of friends globally, who, especially in the US, who grew up in religious environments, who are very family, and they treat us, especially the younger ones, these people are in their 70s, Midwestern, grew up, moved to the big cities, didn't bring their faith with them, but brought the whole the community perspective of what they had.
Okay.
That is an essential element of low church evangelicalism. I mean, you can't flip in and out of that in the way you can flip in and out of a middle of the road Anglican church in England, for example.
Okay, yeah. So it just left you, I guess, the belief. You were exposed to other things, you eventually...
No, I think the perspective for me was, I thought, well, if I don't believe this, and I did, then what does that mean? And I actually, and it sounds really, really, you know, Sude's corner. I was reading Albert Camus' Flight to Arras. He's an existentialist, of course. Mm-hmm. And and I remember there's a bit in that book about where he's, you know, it's a hopeless mission. The Nazis have taken over. He's going to get shot down. It's a reconnoiter mission. And he's seeding the clouds. He's talking about, you know, seeding the clouds and the contrail. Apparently they're known as chemtrails now to the paranoid. The contrail of his pre-jet plane as he's flying. And I remember reading that when I was in my 20s. And in my 30s, when I had said, oh, that's, I'm not believing this anymore, I suddenly realized it was a relief not to try and be hypocritical about it or try and force it. And I remembered that book because I remember looking up at the sky and seeing a contrail. Yeah. And it wasn't that I thought Albert Camus was the biz. It was just... I remembered thinking that I was thinking about the now. Yeah. This is what, life is just life. And I always worried that if I thought life was just life, it would worry me, but it didn't. And that sounds really...
I think it worried Camus, didn't it?
Yeah, it worried Camus a lot. Yeah. So I realized
that wasn't Camus.
The plague is there as well, isn't it?
Because
okay, well, Stephen, let's ask you then. You retained your faith.
Yeah.
What do you think made you hang in there and stick with it?
It's not that I wouldn't have checked it against everything that was going on in life. If you do a postmodern lit degree at Curtin University the day after your parents split up from you were Christian, it is going to challenge you. I think the stronger question that people ask me is, why did you remain a Christian rather than how did you become one? Because becoming one is easy in that sort of community setting. It's the natural default. But why I remained one is because I guess there's an intellectual perspective to it, that I believe that it is true. And that I believe that historically it's true, but also that existentially it was true for me. And I think what David said about being focused when he went to university that second year, I was going to use the same word about him because I was the opposite. I was unfocused for about 5 or 6 years, not sure of things, very unhappy about it, but couldn't quite land what I was supposed to do. But in that mix, I'd gone from a church experience that was very tight to quite a Pentecostal church experience, which seemed to, it seemed to give a certain reality to the things that in the previous church experience had been talked about, but didn't feel powerful enough when family splits up and things like that. And I kind of kept going. And it was only, I think, when I went to theological college that I started to put the big pieces together intellectually. So we've always had intellectual repartee, I think, we have between us. And I've always been a reader and a thinker. So I would read Camus' The Plague and I'd be thinking, that's interesting. I think he wants something of meaning in that. He's brave enough to say there is none, though I don't believe him. But I don't think that can be sustained in a culture over a very, very long period of time. I think when meaning runs out, ethics follows it, to be honest.
Both of you have mentioned to me in the past that you enjoy the kind of back and forth discussing these things.
Yeah.
So, David, what is the most frustrating thing for you about Stephen's belief? And I'm going to ask him the same sort of reverse question.
I think you have to be very careful not to traduce what other people believe. So most of the people that I work with are concerned with how to make other people's lives better. And I think that's a very lawful, valid thing. I mean, Christian Aid, I know they're a liberal lefty group, had a campaign in the UK, we believe in life before death. And most of the people I work with are not interested in shopping and blah, blah. They're interested in life before death and in making people's lives better. I actually think that's not quite an understanding that Stephen might have. I also think that he thinks there's a huge panoply of beliefs. I don't believe that. I believe there is, you believe in the supernatural or you don't. And I see that as a strict definition between you. You either believe in the supernatural or you believe in the natural. I know a few people who think there's a boundary there. My wife is one of those people. But I make that distinction quite strongly.
Okay, Steve, in your turn, most frustrating thing about David's assessment of these things?
You know, the primary thing would be that the scientific method can't be proven by the scientific method, the classic line, I suppose. I don't disagree, and I think I've spoken to people about this, that I don't think that, you know, you plunge yourself into evil hedonism and self-focus if you aren't a Christian or aren't supernatural, because I think that doing good is innate because it's built in by the Creator to do good. So for me, the most frustrating thing is I do think that sometimes that perspective, that binary perspective, is unhelpful and can be read back into an historical understanding of Christianity that somehow, as we become more progressive in our understanding of science, that we'll jettison the Christian frame, which gave science its meaning, the Christian frame, because its understanding of how history worked and the divide between created order and creation. And the great scientists were Christian. Not all of the great scientists were
Christian. That's a reading of it, but they also put them in jail or, you know, burned them at the stake for believing things that weren't actually straight from their own.
And I would say that's a reading of how that happened as well, because I think the Christian frame has something that other frameworks didn't have and didn't raise Western science. Western science came out of Western science not because the Enlightenment appeared magically, but because that was itself built off the back of something bigger than itself. So I don't believe in the subtraction story, as Charles Taylor talks about you just strip away the dogmas and we'll get down to bedrock truth. I think everyone has a story, and it's built on a set of presuppositions that they can't completely, and this is where epistemological humility comes in, easy to say.
Big words.
Yeah. That comes in and says, just at least be a little bit humble about your epistemology. And I think Christians need to do that, and we would say the same. Northern Ireland didn't do that.
That's correct.
Would that be right?
Correct.
Where it's, the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it. Where I go, yeah, well, you know, I'm committed to... Yeah, it's a lot more complex than that.
Stephen, you, I want to ask you about... You had a life-threatening illness. Yeah. You were very ill for about a year, I think it was. Mm. What way was that shaping you? Mm. And did that have any effect on you, David? But Steve, go for it.
Look, I remember it was 10 years ago, that 10 years ago this month that I got sick. I didn't pick myself as sick. I just started to lose weight very rapidly.
He was a fat porker at the time.
Really?
I was 83 kilos and now I'm about 65. But I lost 23 kilos really quickly, and I started to feel off, like just off, not generally not well. And then one day, bang, such chronic pain, diagnosed quickly with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Huge shock. It was interesting that my friend said it as well, even though it was such grief-stricken time for my wife Jill and our kids. It felt like I pulled the levers of my Christian faith and it worked. It wasn't, how dare you do this to me? You don't exist anymore. It felt like this is right and this is working. Death is a huge issue for the Christian, for the non-Christian, for whoever. Death is a huge issue. And I felt it's going to happen now. In the end, it was a misdiagnosis of a severe case of pancreatitis, but it still put me out of action for a year. And I felt I came back, moved from being a young man in my thinking to be a much more sober-minded person post that time. The hard thing, I think, for us was it gutted us both.
I was crushed by it.
Yeah.
The thought of him going, I mean, you're twins.
Yes, and that's still to come somewhere along the line. That's hard.
Exactly. The twin thing is very important, and there isn't a closer relationship I have or a possibility of thinking what would be more traumatic than that. And I understand that with my wife, who's also a twin, she has the same relationship with her twin, and there's only, you know, there's someone who's more important than your wife to you, who's your twin brother. You know, that's a funny concept to have. And she, I know, feels the same way with respect to her twin, and that's a big part of our relationship, our twininess. She's not an identical twin, but that doesn't matter.
The thought of Stephen dying and your non-belief factored into that, you'd have to say then, at that point, that's it, it's all over, and what?
Well, I never believed in heaven, I always believed in hell.
Right.
Because okay. You get that drummed into you at Sunday school.
Yeah, in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, okay.
It was a challenging time for us because it projected the future to us very quickly. It sort of concertinaed things to one day this will happen. And that is a difficult concept at one stage, to think, wow, we've lived in the context of each other in our minds for so long,
our consciousness. But I think Stephen made the point. I don't agree necessarily with how the only way he projected it about being concertinaed. Well, I think that is the case. But I think the major transformation for me, looking at Stephen, was he stopped being a woolly, all over the shop sort of person and became very focused, including on himself in a good way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did that at university. I said, okay, I'm getting focused. And Stephen spent the time drifting from one family to another around various happy clappy churches.
That's a nice. If only you'd told me that at the time.
he wasn't listening at the time. But when he was ill, I remember him saying, and it was in January when he got the right diagnosis, and I think had surgery, and he was really down. Oh, I'm not going to work for a year, sort of scenario. And friends of mine from the US who had big stomach cancer, stomach surgeries, not cancer, had said those sort of things really knock you for six.
Yeah.
And they actually hit you depressively, etc. There's a
and
real
that was
perspective.
The experience, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was very much the experience. But I think he came out of that more hard-nosed.
Mm. And Jill, my wife, has said exactly the same thing, that changed me to the focus issue very strongly.
Correct, yeah. So I'd always thought of Stephen as sort of a bit of a flibbergigibbet, you know, bouncing around. And
scientist, you?
Yeah, no, seriously. I do things like host parties at conferences I go to, do stand-up comedy, do outrageous things, even wear a mini skirt on stage while doing stand-up comedy.
That's passé these days.
I know, but nevertheless, I have good legs. The key thing there is I always know where I'm focused. I always know how to get back from being a bit of a lair, and I'm not a super lair, but just, I know how to do that. I know where I am, and I know what that core perspective is. So those things are just accoutrements that I do for fun, but actually this is core. I didn't feel Stephen had that steeliness of not looking after himself, projecting himself in a focused way.
Yeah.
And I think he does now.
Obviously involved in ministry most of that time, and it wasn't that I was crashing and burning everything in ministry because I couldn't focus. But I do think that after I recovered from that, two things struck me. One was I haven't probably been as focused clearly like that. Here's how it projected itself to me a little bit. I felt grief-stricken that I haven't given my family enough time off for holidays and things to concentrate on us. And it was that seems so little but so huge at the same time when you're going through a death experience or near-death experience.
And I think there's a difference in what Stephen does before and after in terms of ministry. Stephen made the mistake of going into youth ministry when he still hadn't grown up.
Yeah, thanks for that. I still haven't grown up.
Isn't that part of the job description?
No, it is. But actually, when you've got a family, when you've got you move from being part of this, you know, I was part of that too, where that is a very strong family. There's a lot of emotionalism in there. There's a lot of support. There's also a lot of crisis management, etc. And if you're doing that as ministry, it's very hard to pull out of. And there were some occasions where Stephen was very hit by tragedies.
We've had some tragedies in church, which I think
really hit him.
Hit me hard. And coming out of the other side of those has made me, I can still deal with people in a compassionate way, but I am able to stand above that situation. And that's made me, I think, better in leading in church and better in making decisions in a crisis moment. So I am the go-to crisis guy in lots of our pastoral care issues because I know how to stand above it now.
I would say that's very true. A big difference between before Stephen was ill and after he was ill, that he was able to do what he admired in a lot of other ministers he saw, which was not take the work home with you. Mm. You know, not have
so
the vicarage
true.
Door open the whole time.
Yeah, that changed immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And that's prioritizing properly.
Mm. Stephen, tell us the best thing and the hardest thing about being a believer.
The best thing about being a believer is the joy of what Jesus has done for me, I would think. That'd be a trite way of saying that's the tip of a very big iceberg of what it means. The hardest thing about being a believer is that the gap between who I am called to be and the gap and who I am. So it's an existential issue, and it does feel that. At the same time, knowing the best bit about that is that of what Jesus did for me. I'm trying to put those in a symbiotic relationship. But I think that gap between who you are and who you're called to be is something, as an internalizing thinker, as someone who speaks to myself more than I speak to anyone else, that's key.
Bit of grace important for gap, Steve. Yeah. Same question for you, David. Best and hardest thing about being a non-believer?
I think that has to be put in the context of what I actually do and think of as being a scientist, for example. I believe strongly now that the idea that you're on a spectrum of behavior, of life, of even sexuality in some cases, although that's a much more DNA-wired perspective, all of those things are part of you and expressed differently or not, and people are on spectra of a whole range of different things. We talk about the spectrum now of, you know, attention deficit disorders and, you know, autism, etc. People aren't binary, one or the other like that. And when you believe they're not, it makes you more accepting of people. The challenge is for people who don't believe that to be accepting of them as well. I think in terms of downsides, perspective of not, it's hard to say that when you actually, you know, I don't even have this view that, oh, it would be really nice if all of this were true. For a huge, the vast majority of the world's population, it really matters to them and is core to their being, and that being is generally someone I want to speak with and interact with and be with. So why would I see that bad? But for myself, I think I survived some of the external bits of what belief was, and those not only survived them, some of them helped me thrive. I don't think I would have been inquisitive or inquiring without having a Christian belief system, because I had no other access to it. I'd been inquisitive and inquiring. But I don't think I regret or there's any hard bit of that other than the interactions with people for whom it might be difficult. My mother being one.
She's fairly understanding.
More understanding.
My final question for both David and Stephen was, what do they wish for their twin? Firstly, Stephen.
I wish he would become a Christian because of what I believe about what humanity's for and who humanity is created for. Created for the glory of God. And I think David does many good things. I'm very proud of my twin brother. And I do speak about him in glowing terms to people. And we have a great relationship. And I'm really impressed with what he does and the integrity with which he does it, I have to say. And I think that's a pointer to something beyond. And that would be my wish.
And now, David.
I don't know. I think he's got everything in his sphere that actually makes him happy for what he is and how he lives it. I wish that he didn't worry about me so much, but I also wish he'd cut that great big beard off. I think it would be hard to say there's a single wish there. I wished for Stephen to be happy in a very specific time. He talked about having that cancer scare. And my wish at that time, I wished that Stephen had been more happy about himself and with himself and internally calm at that point. I believe he now has that. So it's strange that although I was totally gutted about his illness, and I was also, you know, having to think about my own as identical twin, there's a huge risk factor associated with pancreatic cancer if you're a twin, but that was minor. For me, I remember telling people, I wish Stephen had been happier in himself in the preceding time because he was engaged with a lot of things that were actually quite negative just before.
It's interesting.
That. And I got my wish.
There you go. There must be a God then.
Yeah. Can we write that down?
David, McAlpine, Stephen, it's great to have you guys in. Thanks for giving us your time. It's great.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Simon.
Thanks for joining us on Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. It'd be great if you'd share this episode with someone you think might enjoy it. Also, follow us on social media, you know, the drum, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Next week.
So I had Pope John Paul II sitting at the table with him in his study, and he said, and where's your next posting, Your Excellency? I said, well, in fact, I'm going to study for the priesthood. Oh, you? Yes. And he said, this is what we call a late vocation. I said, no, Your Holiness, it's an early vocation, long deferred. And he had a bit of a smile.